Welcome to the Speaker's Corner Show. My name is Heiko Kuh. This week's show is a recording of my own meeting from the 14th of June 2009. You can visit our website at speakerscorner.net. Come down to Speaker's Corner and join us any Sunday afternoon until sundown. Or tune in on 104.4 Resonance FM at on Fridays at 2:30 p.m.
I'm sure you encounter plenty of people like me.
You know, Karl Marx, when he founded the first... when he shifted the emphasis of the First International, there was a lot of conflict in the International, and eventually he sort of arranged to shut it down and moved it to New York, and he said maybe for a half year he said now I can get down to some serious theory. And so he wanted to spend, you know, a few years studying. So I don't think there's per se a contradiction. A human being composed of, you know, a different phase in your life, different thing, you might one day play an important role in shifting one emphasis in one thing. You might spend suddenly your whole life, you might never do, you might just talk to people. You know, life is about that, isn't it? Look at who we got at Speaker's Corner, you know.
That's what I wanted.
We got quite a good cross-section of humanity.
Do you think so? That's what I was going to ask.
I think we do. I mean, we have some disproportions because of the location, but otherwise we have a good cross-section of humanity, a fair mix of the people here. The consequence of that is that we can see all these processes, you know, revolutionary, conservative, reactionary, you know, religious fundamentalists, you know, all sorts of different strands we can observe here. And so we can see the tendencies developing within society quite well, I think.
This was my question, because I just don't agree with that. I look at these people here, and on the whole, I see kind of freak circus stuff going on. I mean, I use that in a nice way. I mean to say that the amount of serious, engaged conversation going on here, and I'm not trying to flatter you, because I don't believe you to be, you know, I've heard, but in general, would you regard yourself as typical of the speakers at Speaker's Corner? I mean, most of the people here strike me as not typical, not people I would want to listen to.
There's a girl who came up to me a little while ago. She wanted to make a film, and she says, oh, at least you allow people to discuss. And the truth of the matter is, quite a lot of discussion degenerates at one level or other into that sort of level. Not that people shout at each other in that way, but even the religious conflicts are often of that nature. They don't go into any depth. And there is not an attempt to answer questions with genuine investigation of the issues, right? That's perfectly true. But the world is composed not of clearly defined ideas that people shape out of knowledge. Their views are shaped by conditions, and so you get this subdivision of the world, not according to ideas. People think that's the case, but it's not, but according to conditions. Man's condition shapes his view. Not everybody, but pretty much overall it's true. And so I'm not surprised that the discussions have the characteristic not of a genuine engagement and exchange of ideas, but a clash of egos around interests. And that's really what the general form of discussion at Speaker's Corner represents. And you see, I sometimes play on that at the meeting. Why? Because there's people come to my meeting, and from the moment they begin to express themselves, I will know pretty much where they're going to come. What they're going to come with, and then I'll lean on that and expose through that the class contradictions within society through the argument and the division of the audience between conflicting forces. But I try and do it in a way that's pleasant enough so that we don't have a fight, you know, and that people can sometimes have a laugh, even if we disagree, because by bringing people together in a relatively happy, enjoyable discussion, then, but exposing the class contradictions, I hope that in some way I give people an idea of a society of the future where class contradictions are not the dominant issue. So where you can surpass, where you can always have a sense of communism as a consequence of the way in which we engage in entertainment.
Have you found, because of what's happened in the law, I don't know if you remember, maybe about 8-9 months ago, I made a passing comment. I said, I think your time is coming. I don't know if I meant that to be dramatic, or have you found in the last 8-9 months that people have been more open to things that they were never open to in the... So for example, your typical audience 2 years ago might have been completely hostile to a basic proposition that you would have had to spend 20 minutes, half an hour defending, now just gets taken for granted in a minute.
Fundamental
propositions. And could you give some examples of those?
The fundamental propositions of socialism are now mainstream viewpoint of the majority. That's my opinion.
Give some examples of
those. In particular, public ownership of the banks, and I've refocused my discussion as a consequence of feeling that attitude within the population. I've reshifted my discussion to a discussion that through the banks you can bring about socialism, because it's an avenue into people's minds. And then the political crisis recently brought out a lot of discontent. But people's discontent doesn't find, you know, because I am a Marxist, I've got quite a clear ideological frame. People's viewpoints aren't formulated in that way. They're formulated by interests. And so the way they begin to conflict and the issues that they might conflict on are not the terrain that I would have chosen. But I then have to find a pathway in to engage them at that level. So the issue of the banking system, I focused on public ownership and democratic control, which I think is the overwhelming viewpoint of the majority now. What does it mean, public ownership and democratic control of the banks? It means socialism. But it's a rose by any other name for most people. Because if you say socialism, they think Soviet Union, communism, red flag, dictatorship, tried and failed. That's what they think. So you've still got that. I did notice, though, and it's empirical, it's not scientific, but a rough empirical analysis. The last couple of weeks, there's a fight back by the right. It's a fight back by the right. In the meetings, I've noticed it. People who shut up for 7 months after the collapse of Lehman Brothers suddenly are coming out with it again. And so they need a pummeling again. But this time it's different, because the facts have disproven them. Now they're hoping, it's just hope, that the mood will change. Oh, we got the right wing got elected. You know, someone came out to me a minute ago, Justin, I believe it is. He's a day trader by profession, so fundamentally sort of right wing viewpoint, a capitalist type, petty capitalist viewpoint. He was, oh well, but they voted for the right. Well, they voted for the right, but not in big numbers, and with no enthusiasm. And so the right wing will suffer the consequences of trying to resolve the crisis of capitalism, which is irresolvable but for them. So for this reason, I think the main shifts are that. There is a fundamental shift in overall consciousness. There is not, however, a shift towards solidarity yet in Britain. In France, Greece, probably Spain and Italy, yes. But in Britain, not yet. There is, however, a dislike of the way things are. And that dislike of the way things are reflects itself in the dislike of the political structure, of the economic structure, and also, peculiar enough, the re-emergence of the dislike of foreigners.
But you see, I'm not sure if I agree with you, because the thing that I've encountered, once again, empirically, not science, isn't so much the notion that capitalism has collapsed or capitalism is showing us.
Sure.
It's quite the opposite. This is an aberration. This is a, the car was fine, we had a flat tire.
That's right.
Kind of thing. And I always say, no, we didn't have, actually the engine was badly built. Or, you know, and the idea really, it's a question of reparative, corrective, reparate, whatever the word is, corrective, fixing, this didn't work, that didn't work, but if you make a little bit of a fix and a mess, a nice little repair, on it goes.
Well,
if anything, that's the attitude I've encountered, not...
That's perfectly correct. I said there were shifts in consciousness on certain issues, the banking system, which enabled me, if I put it, and I I'd be quite clear, I have to put it a bit subtly. I have to say, well, the banking will take over the banking system. And then I say the biggest companies, but first the banking system, because people accept that. And so you have to deal with people's consciousness. Having said that, what does that actually mean? It means that if you can win people on that question, actually you can win them to socialism. Does that mean they're socialist now? Not at all. What they actually think at the moment is exactly what you described, quite correct, quite accurate. The problem is the issue for me is what's the dynamic? What's the direction? Because I accept what you say. Most people think there's been a small problem, it's been largely resolved, and things are gradually going to get better. There might be a few blips on the way, but gradually things will get better, and then things will be back to normal. But actually, it is the contradiction. What drives revolution is the contradiction between the hope of the population that the system they live under will continue to function adequately for the majority, and the inability of that system to do that. If that was not the case, if capitalism was able to re-emerge and expand indefinitely, with less of that blip on the way like we had in the autumn, like we've had until now, then there will be no reason for revolution. And there will, in fact, be no revolution. There might be crises, there might be revolution, but they'll restore the old order eventually. Unless the system is unable to do that. And it is the contention of Marx, and that was his brilliant insight, was to analyse the way in which the system is compelled to behave in a certain way, to end up in a certain condition, and therefore compels the majority to enter the road of struggle against that system. Not because they want to, in fact, precisely the opposite, because they do not want to. That's why revolution happens. Revolution happens because people don't want a revolution. Because if the system can continue, keep going, and people get some money again, get on again, advance themselves, and gradually tomorrow is better than day before, and so on and so forth, the day after better than tomorrow, then capitalism will continue. If, however, that is not the case, and the capitalism enters into severe crises which bring people to question the system they live under, then people will revolt. And I pointed out earlier on that the cracking lines at the moment are actually in countries that appeared, or I can give some illustrations, that appeared to be doing very well.
Like the Baltic states.
The Baltic states, Latvia in particular, I understand, Latvia is on the edge of insurrection. Because if that economy collapses and people's expectations suddenly are dashed, what are people going to do? Iceland. Iceland was the fifth richest country per capita on Earth. Fifth highest living standard. Some people said the highest living standards. And yet Iceland, I remember reading an interview with a banker from Iceland. And he said, this was in the autumn though, he said, now I understand why the French cut off the king's head and why the Bolsheviks made a revolution. Now I understand. So there you have the way in which the material condition combined with the effect upon the masses shapes consciousness.
The concern I have is historically capitalism or the free markets had much greater blows than what's happened now. I mean, the Great Depression is probably the uber example, but you know, prior to that there were... Why do you imagine it won't recover? Why do you imagine that or this is the final, or it isn't?
I'm not arguing it's the final crisis of capitalism. There are periods of history which are revolutionary periods. There are periods of history where if you're a revolutionary, you'll just bang your head against the wall all your life. The 1950s and 60s were objectively conditions where revolution was extremely unlikely in the advanced capitalist countries. Some third world countries, developing countries, had revolutions. But even those revolutions, the opportunity for them to spread, yes, you could have had different policies, but the opportunity for them to spread was limited by the general development of the productive forces. There are, however, objective factors involved in revolution. One, the development, according to Marx, the development of the social force able to bring about the new society. So in other words, the emergence of the working class as a class itself. Now, if you take the last 30 years, there has been the biggest increase in the total number and in the social specific weight of the working class across the entire planet. That is, of course, not the case in the richest countries in the world, but it is the case in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. That is a fundamental reordering on the one side of the global balance of political forces, but also the global balance of class warfare.
So it's like what happened pre-industrial revolution when all the people moved off
the
farms.
Industrial revolution, to be honest with you, was a local affair. It was a local affair in England, you know, a tiny country of 4 million people. France, Germany, to some degree. Germany only came late 1860s, 70s. Belgium, you know, and then later Japan and America. These were developments of up to possibly, in terms of industrial, affected by industrial capitalism, integrated to the system of industrial capitalism. How many were there by 1914? 25 million in the world? 25 million? Let's put this in perspective then. The total working class of America is around, in terms of workers, around 146 million. The total working class of Europe, 216 million. The total new working class in the People's Republic of China in the last 30 years, 333 million. So in other words, the entire development of America and Europe has happened industrially in China in the last 30 years. And Europe and America developed over 400 years to reach that point. The first shoots of industry developed in England actually before, even 600 years ago. But the emergence of capitalism 400 years ago, most of that compressed into 50 years, 1850 to 1900. And so you begin to understand this question that Marx raised about the balance of class forces leads me as a Marxist to be quite optimistic. Why am I optimistic? Not because of London, but because of India, China, Latin America, and Africa. That's why I'm optimistic, because the objective balance of class forces is in favor of the proletariat, unlike any previous time in history. The working class, by their very nature, I was at Dagenham the other day, Ford Dagenham. I interviewed a former car worker from there, shop steward. And I discussed with him this question. What is it about the working class? Why are they described by Marx as the revolutionary class? It is because of the condition of large-scale industry and large-scale economic operations bringing together thousands or millions of people into combination that leads to a consciousness of socialism. When I worked, I tell you the difference. I worked in a little shop when I was from the age of 14. I worked in a bakery, then I worked in a greengrocer. And you got the boss, and you got two boys, me and the other lad, and then you got the boss's sister, and we're all working there. He counts the cash, we get paid 50 pence an hour. That was how it was, 50 pence an hour in the late 70s. Now, where is the clash? He's taking money, I'm working, but all right, I'm a kid, you know, I'm doing some work, he's making money out of me, fine. But then if you have, like I worked in the buses, at Victoria Garage at the time, 500 workers, repair workers, drivers, mechanics, financial staff, management, there's a totally different consciousness. We are organizing as bus workers, the entire transport, or a part of the entire transportation of the city. And I tell you, strange sort of way to express it, but there was that feeling. You had a feeling. We are bringing the people, making the city work. It was that feeling. And it reflects itself the moment you have a strike. I actually organized a strike when I was there in solidarity with the health workers. And this was again interesting. I went in my uniform to Charing Cross Hospital. I addressed the nurses meeting of 400 nurses. I said, what I want you to do, because they had a dispute at the time about wages, and they were living in poverty conditions. And I said, what I want you to do is to come down to the bus garage and speak to the bus drivers and the conductors. So this nurse came there, two of them came there, sat there, pretty young girls, you know, sat there explaining that they're exhausted, worn out, in tears, changing sheets that should have been changed 2 days ago. And you should have seen these bus drivers, all the sort of burlies and all that, in tears they were at the meeting. Because that solidarity existed between the workers of the different sectors. And we saw each other's, not as nurse or bus driver, but as workers. So that unity existed, which is a unity of consciousness created by the objective conditions of modern society. Not by the will of communists, not even by communists, but by the capitalist development of the productive forces. A class has emerged which can and will take over the running of society and reorganize it, because they have it in their hands to reorganize. It is the very nature of their condition that they can and will reorganize. They can reach that consciousness and will reach that consciousness, because the moment they take action, they realize their condition. Probably, my own guess is, because you tell me you talk about it a lot, but you don't do anything, probably you don't work in large-scale industry. My guess. You probably work in a small or on your own. My own guess. So the circumstances determine. So your relationship then collectively is something like Speaker's Corner, or perhaps a meeting you could go to, or a demonstration, but it's not organic to your condition as a worker. And for that reason, the same with myself. For that reason, it's the large scale operations that are the instruments of change. Let me give you another illustration. The development of the city. In the village, what unity can you create? One's a farmer, one's a petty business person. You know, you've all got separate interests. You meet down the pub, oh, how's your farm? So, superficial talk. But in the city, it's integrated. People come up to me earlier on. This man comes up to me earlier and he goes, what about tube strike? Because he was affected. That's the point. I was affected.
And he's not London, he's not British.
No, but that's right, that's
yeah,
right.
He's not British.
What about tube strike?
Yeah, yeah.
So he gets on to worker. Tube strike, worker, employer, organization of the city. Everything becomes within the grasp of us, whether you agree or not with a tube strike. It becomes something amendable, adjustable, alterable. This is the consciousness of the working class.
What do you make of the nature of those?
Sure.
Oh, okay. My question is that you are talking about the revolution due to some reasons. After revolution, after the working class has got the power to run, to operate, to control the society, the companies, what can they do? What can they prevent the revolution again? What can they manage very, very well? And the situation is that always the controlling the ruling class and the working class, it's a contradiction. How can you prevent that?
There is a contradiction, and this contradiction can basically only be resolved by reorganizing the balance of control of power.
Ownership.
What does that mean? It means that instead of, like in England, one in every 12 workers in England or in Britain is a supervisor. And they are appointed from the management to ensure that the labour power, full-time supervisor, that the labour power of the others is organised most effectively for the extraction of profit. Now, that's quite logical under capitalism. But under socialism, it's the opposite. We should elect the supervisor to serve the interests of the worker and production. Now, actually, there's no contradiction. Because everyone knows, anyone who's ever worked anywhere, knows fully well that they know their job best. In other words, they can improve their work if there's a reason for them to do it. Most of the time, a worker doesn't have any reason to improve his work. Why? Because if I suggest, well, why don't we do it this way instead of that way, and we get the job done much faster, then the employer will say, okay, you do it much faster, then you get on with that. So they give you more work.
Yes.
Instead of reducing the burden and making it better for you. Instead of you improving the condition for everybody, it becomes a mechanism for increasing your exploitation. And therefore the worker has an interest, that's why they need supervisors. The worker has an interest to do as little as possible. And so that contradiction can be reversed by creating an interest through what I would call work democracy. That gives you pleasure in your work rather than your work being a burden. I think that's a very important psychological distinction.
Good. I really appreciate your speech. Another question is that, do you think in the future, what time the company or enterprises, they don't need to work for profit? They work only for the benefit of the workers. Do you think 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years?
It depends on the sphere of operation that you're talking about. Socialism, the great labor socialist in Britain, was known by the name of Aniram Bevan. And he used a very apposite phrase, in my opinion, and that is, socialism is the language of priorities. So I think that's the essence of the way in which you move in the right direction. You have to identify what the society's priorities are. Now, it's perfectly true that for everybody to have their own personal aeroplane is probably at least 20 to 50 years away. But for everybody to have adequate water, healthcare, education, welfare, a pension, to have the basics of life and live in dignity, somewhere to live, somewhere reasonable to live, with enough space, that is quite a simple priority that is achievable in countries like Britain, probably within 2 or 3 years, if you reorientate the resources for the benefit of the population. The resources necessary to carry out those priorities. That doesn't mean that there won't be other resources privately run or run for the benefit of profit or whatever. The question is, what things are not to be run for profit? Well, those things need to be the main priorities of society and the achievable things. Then later, as we simplify the mechanisms of control, computerization, database systems, integration of consumer and producer through such databases, that we would be able to facilitate a more efficient system of organization, which will allow other areas, much wider areas of economic activity, to come within the domain of non-profit activity. But initially, you know, we have to deal with priorities.
That was the Speaker's Corner show for this week. Tune in again next week on 104.4, same time, same place, Friday, 2:30 p.m. Come down to Speaker's Corner any Sunday afternoon and join us until sundown. Or visit our website, speakerscorner.net. That's speakerscorner.net.